This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everyone, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, and I'm joined today with my co-host, Kevin Holloway. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Corinne. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I think I'm doing about as good as any of us are doing these days.
That is a pretty good way to summarize it. Pretty good. I have to say I'm actually doing better than usual today because I'm really excited about our guest.
That's excellent.
Today, and I guess I'll say more about that when I get ready to introduce him. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, this is our final episode of the season.
Yeah.
Season 6 wrapping up.
How
today.
Did the time fly that fast?
Time flies when you're having fun.
That's true.
And interestingly, we got a listener question that is related to the topic of endings. Mm. So it was kind of a perfect listener question to talk about today.
It doesn't always happen that way.
I know. This is pretty clever.
Yeah.
So the person who wrote in, the listener, asked us not to use her name. So,
oh, okay.
So Anonymous from Anonymous Location.
Hi, Anonymous.
Hi, Anonymous. Says, I'd love to hear the team's experiences related to termination of care and how to make these decisions alongside the patient.
Ooh.
In a perfect world, everyone is adherent and motivated, but we all know that can be a challenge due to schedules, avoidance, etc. And many of us have regular turnover of patients due to filled patient schedules and clinic demands, so it's a very hard balance to strike.
For sure.
Yeah. And I thought about how I would answer this question, and I thought that could be an entire episode.
It really could. I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot that could be said there. Yeah.
Yeah. And so much of it varies based on, are you doing a standard protocol where you know mm-hmm. an ending is coming, or at least you anticipate that an ending is coming in a certain mm-hmm. way? Mm-hmm. Is it unexpected?
Yeah.
Is it the patient's preference? Is it your preference? There's so many aspects, even when you're just doing something as simple as an EBP.
Yeah. And really, that's what I was thinking, why it would be a great full episode, right? Because I can think of different scenarios where it's a lot more straightforward than others. I have certainly had my share of cases where it's kind of like, oh, I haven't seen them in a while. I wonder what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're like, oh, are we terminating? Or
right. Was that it? Were we done?
Or probably less commonly where somebody will like email me or leave me a voicemail that says, I'm done,
you know, like right
unexpectedly too. But yeah, there's a lot that can impact how do you do termination. I think ideally, of course, we want to know that it's coming and we have thought about it and we're having a collaborative conversation with our clients about what's next. Like, are we mm-hmm. terminating completely? Are we switching focus? Are we referring back to a referral source? But we don't always have that opportunity.
Right. As Anonymous from Anonymous Location said, we don't always have that option, right? It's that decision's made for us. So here's my thought, Kevin. I think I wanted to mention the question, especially since it was so timely with mm-hmm. our final episode of the season, but maybe we start things off next season by talking about this. What do you think?
I love it. Let's do it. Let's plan on that. As long as we don't, you know, like suddenly unexpectedly depart and we're terminated and we
don't go there. Don't go there. Anonymous, we're going to be back. We're going to be back and we will answer your question in the next season. Thank you so much for writing in, listeners. We really do appreciate your questions
absolutely.
And comments.
Absolutely. Keep them coming.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Kevin. So like I said, I'm really excited about our guest today, to have our guest today.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can make it all about me, as I usually do in my introduction, you know that I'm a sleep nerd and that I love treating insomnia and I love working with nightmares, et cetera. I didn't always. And in fact, I avoided it for a very long time.
That's interesting. That could be its own episode.
It's its own episode. Well, I'm just going to give you the preview. I was forced to learn CBTI by my supervisor at the time. Like, I avoided it for months. He wanted me to get trained because we were short on psychologists who knew how to do CBTI. Mm-hmm. He wanted me to get trained, and I avoided the training for months, maybe even years. And then finally he said, oh, you're getting trained. And
Ah,
then I ended up working with our guest, who turned out to be fantastic and turns out is kind of a
okay.
big deal, turns out. So we have Dr. Phil German, and he is responsible for my love of insomnia treatment, believe it or not.
Nice.
Welcome, Phil.
Thank you. If that's all I've achieved, then I have had a successful career.
That is how we are judging your success.
Great.
Beyond the obvious impact that you have made on me, would you introduce yourself to our listeners with what you think is important for them to know about you?
Sure, I'm a clinical psychologist and professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. And I think about sleep all the time because my clinical practice is related to behavioral sleep medicine. My research is all related to insomnia and its importance for PTSD, depression, various mental health conditions. So I think about sleep a lot.
You are also a sleep nurse.
Maybe even more than you, Corinne.
Most likely.
Ooh,
Most
that's a high
likely.
bar.
Yeah, I'm not going to make this into a competition. You can have that one. You can win that one. Well, we're so happy to have you because I know that you have done so much work in this area. You've written this, you've supervised, you've consulted, you have your clinical practice. You are certainly an expert in this field, and we are delighted to have you.
My pleasure.
And when we talked about what we might discuss today, of course, since you think about sleep all the time, there were a bunch of topics that we considered as possibilities, but we landed on talking about obstructive sleep apnea, which maybe is a topic that you don't expect psychologists to talk a lot about or providers to talk a lot about, mental health providers, because we theoretically don't do a lot with that directly. And that's often a medical condition that folks need medical assessment and treatment for.
Corinne, I'm starting to understand now why you invited me to be your co-host today. So,
Why?
oh no, just this is a topic that's interesting to me more personally than it is professionally and clinically. So, I might play that role today of like the what about and just for me. So,
We're actually here to treat you today, Kevin. This is your
good. This is an intervention,
OSA intervention.
free consultation with Phil Kerman.
You
There
got
you
it.
go.
But it turns out that, in fact, not only do behavioral health providers have OSA, but we might also be involved in the in work with it. So, Phil, is that enough of a jumping off point to get started?
It is, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's so critical that behavioral health providers have at least a basic understanding of sleep apnea because the prevalence is so high and it's sort of like you're dealing with it whether you know it or not.
That's a good way to put it. So, how does it most often, do you think, come up for mental health providers?
So a few different ways. One, people are really sleepy during the day, so they're coming in and they're tired, they're fatigued all day, and trying to figure out why that is, especially if you have comorbid, say, depression, which is common there's a link
Right.
between depression and OSA. So are they tired during the day because of their depression, or is there something else going on? And so I think so one of the manifestations might be how people are feeling during the day, but also in terms of what's going on at night. And so there are people who sometimes will show up saying, my problem is insomnia, but it's not really insomnia. It's really underlying sleep apnea that's really driving the problem. And if the and you can spend do CBTI till you're blue in the face, and it's not really going to help in this case because that's not what's driving the problem.
For those of that are listening who have heard the maybe the initials OSA or sleep, even the word sleep apnea, like what's going on physically? Corinne mentioned that it's often thought of as just a medical issue. Like, what is this thing? What is going on for a person who has it?
So basically, what happens is we all have tissue in the back of our airway that relaxes when we sleep. And because that tissue is relaxed, as we breathe in and out, that tissue vibrates and that causes snoring. That's the main cause of snoring. Now, there's lots of people who snore, and that's kind of the extent of the problem. But for some people, that tissue relaxes enough, or the tissues are really large, or the airway's narrow, so that the tissue is actually blocking the airway, either partially or completely blocking the airway. So the person's trying to breathe, but they can't get through because of that obstruction in the airway, hence the name obstructive sleep apnea. So people often think sleep apnea means you stop trying to breathe, and that's actually, there is a rarer subtype of sleep apnea called central sleep apnea where that's the case. But about 90 to 95% of the time, it's not a failure of trying to breathe. It's just that the air is not getting through.
So then this shows up, like you said, sometimes with, some mood impacts and sleepiness during the day. But how else does that impact people? I mean, I could certainly, I've certainly had clients that have been like, so I snore, so what? It's not a problem for me. It's a problem for my partner,
And that is a problem.
Yes.
Studies have shown that when one bed partner has a sleep disorder, such as sleep apnea, their bed partner loses on average an hour of sleep a night. And so sometimes people say, I think I sleep fine, but my bed partner said I need to get this fixed. And so, so there could be these indirect relationship problems as a result of it. But it's a wide range of things. I mean, cognitively, people, I mean, because if this happens like a few times over the course of the night, that's totally normal. But when it's happening over and over and over again all night, your sleep is fragmented. Each time this happens, your temper is getting less oxygen to your brain. So it's associated with cognitive impairment as well. And even things like, so those are some of the more psychological, emotional impacts. But untreated sleep apnea is a risk factor for high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, like you name it. It's bad for you.
Yeah, so we talk about this all the time, how dangerous OSA actually can be just because of how many physical, cognitive, emotional comorbidities it could have, and it affects it can have for sure. It sounds like one of the ways that behavioral health providers can be helpful is in the assessment component, that when you have a patient come in saying, I'm really tired, part of what we need to do is figure out, is OSA a factor here?
Exactly. To figure out, like, does this person actually need a referral to a sleep clinic to see if there's more going on as far as their breathing is concerned at night?
I imagine that's similar to many other things that we will see, right? Somebody comes into our office and they say, I have this problem. We jump right into treatment. We may not be serving them well, right? Like really a good, thorough, comprehensive assessment is always important to try to uncover what's going on. It sounds like, especially in this case, if somebody comes in and says, I have insomnia, or for whatever reason, I think I'm sleeping, but I'm just wasted during the day. We're not going to do well if we're treating OSA with, cognitive behavior therapy for depression, for example, or maybe help a little with the comorbidities. But if we haven't figured out what the root of the issue is, we're not going to be very effective in our interventions.
Absolutely. And I'll use kids as an example of this. So if you look at amongst kids who are diagnosed with ADHD, a subset of them end up having sleep apnea, usually from enlarged tonsils and adenoids. And they get the tonsils and adenoids removed, their sleep apnea is gone, and so is their ADHD.
Interesting.
And so there's a subset of kids who don't actually have ADHD, they have sleep apnea. And so you can do all the ADHD treatments you want, that's not really the problem.
And all the stimulant medications.
Wow, I had not heard that before. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
It's a really good example. Okay, so what if we have a patient who shows up in our office and we use all of our best assessment skills and we determine, oh, this individual probably has some OSA. I should refer them to sleep medicine for an assessment. Is that where my role as a behavioral health provider ends, or is there more I can do?
Yeah, great question. So I think it depends on the situation. If you feel like the sleep apnea, it seems to be like the sole problem, then maybe what you should do is take a step back, say, go kind of get this evaluated, get dealt with. If you're still having lingering issues after that, come back to me. That's kind of like one model. There may be, depending on kind of full spectrum of symptoms, there might be value in beginning psychotherapy while they might have to wait for a while for an appointment with a doc and testing and everything. So, like, you may not want to just leave them on their own for that whole time. And so, I think it just depends on the specific situation.
What would you focus on, like in the psychotherapy in the meantime? And I ask this not because I don't have necessarily a thought about that, but because I've had clients that'll say the same thing, like, okay, well, so I've got sleep apnea. Why is talking about my early childhood experiences or whatever, how is that supposed to help? Like, what? Or somebody gets referred to behavioral health, right, from the sleep clinic or from another provider, And their primary diagnosis is OSA, and they're like, I don't know why I'm here. Somebody sent me here, and maybe they think I'm crazy about having this, snoring thing. Like, what would you even talk about?
So I think I'll give you one scenario. So let's say someone comes in, they're coming in because of insomnia, and you suspect they might have sleep apnea. And what they tell you is, I wake up a lot during the night, and which is a very common symptom for people with sleep apnea, is frequent nocturnal awakenings. But then once I wake up, I can't get back. It's really hard for me to get back to sleep. Well, getting back to hard to get back to sleep, that's not the sleep apnea. That's insomnia now superimposed on top of the apnea. And so there are some studies showing that people, even with untreated sleep apnea, can benefit from CBT for insomnia, for example. And so you might be able to target some of those insomnia symptoms, get them some relief. Then when they end up diagnosed with sleep apnea and start treatment, having insomnia is actually a risk factor for non-adherence to OSA treatment. So if you can
Interesting.
address some of the insomnia, they may then be able to be more successful once they're put on. And I'm specifically speaking here about CPAP treatment.
Oh, you just brought up a whole bunch of things. So first off, talking about the comorbidity between insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea, and we know from working with largely with military populations that that in fact is sometimes the most common sleep disorder diagnosis is actually comorbid insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea. So am I understanding correctly that first of all, this is kind of a significant problem that people want to be aware of?
It is. And what's interesting is there's been kind of a surge of interest in this in the sleep medicine field just in the last few years, because for most of the history of sleep research, you had some people studying sleep apnea and you had other people studying insomnia, and never the two shall meet. And people just stayed in their lane. And then people started to realize, well, actually, the insomnia researchers realized a lot of my patients also have sleep apnea, and the sleep apnea people were doing the same for insomnia. So people started writing these papers of we need to do more work at this intersection. And I think at this point, we still have more papers saying we need to do work in this area than we actually have papers with new data in this area. So it's like there's, but people are saying, look, these co-occur so often and they seem to feed into each other in so many ways that we need to pay a lot more attention to this than we historically have.
Okay, so that's one piece that definitely we agree that there is an overlap and there's a common comorbidity, and maybe we don't know exactly what to do about it yet, but we know we should do some things about it.
Exactly.
And you started to talk about that, which is that working with the insomnia can be helpful, can be a helpful start.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think we overuse the onion layer, onion analogy, but I'm going to use it anyway. Is different layers to people's sleep problems, and we have to do one thing for the insomnia layer, something different for the sleep apnea layer, and the it's you need to do both.
So you mentioned CPAP a minute ago, and as I understand it, that's the most, I don't know, certainly the most effective therapy for obstructive sleep apnea, like 100% effective, as long as people are compliant, right? And so I'm curious about that then. Is there a role for behavioral health providers then? I think we mentioned compliance a few times, and compliance with CPAP therapy.
There's a huge potential role that really is untapped. And I would say, even in sleep medicine, within behavioral sleep medicine, my field, we often don't do a lot of this in part because we have such a long waiting list of people who want CBTI that even we don't get much of a chance to do the CPAP work that could be done. But there are, but absolutely, I mean, if you look at PAP, and for anyone not familiar with the acronym, although I think everybody is these days, it's positive airway pressure. And so the idea is people wear this mask at night that is connected by a hose to kind of a shoebox size unit next to the bed that's pumping air down their airway all night so that that tissue is unable to cover the airway. And you're right, when people use it, it's very effective. I had one patient tell me trying to use it was like trying to sleep with his head out the car window driving down the highway.
I love that.
And so it's not pleasant.
Yeah, it sounds like that was not a good thing. It sounds like
No, no,
he
no,
felt that
no.
was bad.
Yes. Yeah, that was not meant to be a selling point for
Good clarification.
yes. We're not putting that in the commercials anytime soon. And but It's not surprising that, only about 50% of people actually use their machine enough to get therapeutic
Wow.
benefit from it. And so there's a lot of unused CPAP machines sitting next to people's beds.
So that, I mean, that blows my mind. 100% effective therapy, and maybe half of people still not using it. So, like you mentioned, that feeling of sticking your head out the window while the collar's going. Are there other things that get in the way with compliance? Like what are people citing when they're saying, I can't do this. This is too much.
I mean, the comfort, I think comfort's probably number one, because here you're getting in bed with the intention of relaxing, go to sleep, going to sleep. But now you're trying to do that with a mask pumping air down your airway. And so it's uncomfortable. I mean, fortunately, the equipment has come a long way. Quieter, the
Right.
masks are more comfortable. There's a lot of options out there. Now, I will say, so one of the pieces is like the equipment piece. And because it's not uncommon that people need to try two, three, four masks before they find one that works well for them. So sometimes our role can be like, well, like people come in, oh, I tried CPAP and it didn't work. Well, did you try multiple masks? And maybe can we get them back into the sleep center to try some new equipment? Because it could be that just with some troubleshooting around the equipment, that's all they need. Another really common issue is claustrophobia. And so, for some people, just again, having that mask over your mouth, some of the masks just go over the nose, some cover the nose and the mouth. That can heighten, trigger whatever claustrophobia people have, make people feel uncomfortable, drive their anxiety up. And so that's another huge barrier. And then you have like the whole piece of, for people with bed partners, that it's like, well, I mean, what is wearing this machine at night going to do to our kind of sleeping together, our intimacy? And so there's kind of those relational issues as well.
Not so sexy, huh?
Not really. I mean, I guess it depends on your bed partner's tastes.
Right. You never know. So I hadn't thought about the fit of the mask, and even just as a behavioral health provider, being able to encourage them to try something else. Just because the first pair of shoes that you try on isn't comfortable doesn't mean the next one won't be. Don't stop wearing shoes. Try a different pair of shoes, right? So I love that. Are there other ways that we could be helpful in those areas?
Especially for the claustrophobia, or just like, even if it's not to that full extent, but just the anxiety that people experience wearing the machine, there's some really great, basically systematic desensitization protocols out there. And so I very commonly am working with patients to say, okay, well, how about if we start that I want you to just take your mask, no hose, no air, and keep it next to your recliner or, where you sit to relax. And just wear it when you're watching TV, reading a book, those sorts of things. So it just becomes second nature. Then start doing that at night and wearing it in bed, again, no hose and no mask, and just slowly, building that stimulus hierarchy and just kind of building up to use to ease people into that experience. And that can be very effective at reducing that anxious response that people get.
That's great. And then I'm guessing with the last item that there might be some work that we could do in terms of helping patients with any misconceptions or concerns that they have about bringing CPAP into the bedroom with their bed partner.
Exactly. And I'll tell you one piece of education I like to give people that can be helpful is one of the effects of sleep apnea can be impaired sexual function in men. And so I tell them, well, wearing your CPAP may actually enhance things in the bedroom. And
Who doesn't
I've
want
had
that?
some patients for whom, like, they say they come back after they've been wearing it for a month and they say, I'm never going back because my Lovelace is better than it's ever been.
Wow, that is one area of life that we did not discuss about previously that might be impacted by sleep apnea. And I could see why that would be a selling point potentially.
When I think about it too, I mean, I mentioned I have a personal connection here. So I use a CPAP every night. And kind of have we don't have enough time to go through the whole long story about when I first started using it, but I'll say the first night that I had it on, I had it on for about an hour, and I was like, can't do this, and took it off and whatever. And it's a good, I mean, in some ways, I kind of maybe had an advantage because I work with a lot of sleep nerds, I think is what Corinne called herself, right? And have heard a lot of the, support around it. Hey, this is 100% effective therapy. You get, compliance is the biggest issue. And it's like, I better try it again the next night. And it really only took that long. It was just one more night, and waking up the next day going, oh my gosh, I am so much more rested. I didn't even realize there was a problem. I was one of those people that was like, I'm sleeping fine. My wife thinks there's a problem, but there's not a problem. Like, she would even give me the snore report in the morning, like, you snored this many times last night. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I was awake when you pretended I was snoring. And then she recorded me, and I was like, all right, I guess I better talk to someone. But it was like night and day difference when I was, using it and using it well. And I will say, I agree with you about the hardware, because mine is called a CPAP, but I think it's probably more like a BiPAP, where on the exhale it changes the pressure, and so it's a lot less uncomfortable. It's not like I'm trying to breathe out against a wind, but it night and day difference. During the day, not sleepy like I remember being years ago when I wasn't using it, and just like you said, I'm never going back because it's been such a big difference for my own functioning.
And when people have your experience, adherence tends to be higher. Like, yeah, there are people who say this has been just a life changer for me. There are other people who, despite using CPAP, still continue to feel tired during the day, and they don't feel a benefit from it. So as you can imagine, adherence tends to be lower in those individuals. One of the things we like to do in those cases is there's some really nice evidence out there for using motivational interviewing approaches or interviews enhancement to improve CPAP use, where you, again, we're trying to tap into that intrinsic motivation to want to use it, tying it to people's values, things like that. And there's been some nice work done by Mark Aloya, where just showing that using these motivational approaches can be very helpful for increasing adherence.
That's great to hear. I know we have a lot of listeners who actually are very interested in motivational interviewing, who write to us and tell us they liked when we talked about motivational interviewing. So this is going to be very interesting to them.
I mean, what isn't motivational interviewing a good fit for? I mean,
Well, there is that. Yeah. Well, that kind of brings me to the last part that I wanted to touch upon, which you and I talked about offline, Phil. A thing, something that I didn't think about before is that you said there might also be a role for behavioral health providers in terms of weight management and how that relates to OSA. So could you tell us more about that?
So being overweight is a significant risk factor for sleep apnea. Although I will say we have this kind of stereotype of the person with sleep apnea being really overweight, but there are lots of thin people with sleep apnea as well. So this is not the sole risk factor, but it is a significant risk factor. And for some people, even a 10-pound weight loss can sometimes be enough to push them into that no apnea range. Like, sometimes a small amount of weight loss can go a long way when it comes to sleep apnea.
So, and this is maybe an uninformed question, so please help me out here. You mentioned weight loss. That might be a big, huge determining factor there, kind of push them out of OSA. I've also heard that once you start CPAP therapy, for example, you're kind of going to be doing CPAP therapy for the rest of your life. And I think maybe that can be daunting to some people too. Like, this isn't, it's not like you use this for a year and then you're done and you get off of it. But is that, number one, I wanted to check to see if that's accurate. But number two, what about for those folks that are just like, look, I've tried all the stuff and this CPAP's not the thing. Are there alternatives for them to try too?
So in the absence of any, if nothing else changes in the individual, yes, kind of once CPAP, always CPAP. Like, sleep apnea does not just go away on its own, as far as we know. Now, getting back to the weight loss, like, for some people, having to use CPAP is a good motivator because weight loss is hard. Weight loss is difficult, and which I think is why you don't hear about it talked about as much with sleep apnea, because I think a lot of people have just thrown up their hands and given up on helping people lose weight. But if people start CPAP but then lose some weight, they may no longer need the CPAP over time. As far as alternatives, I mentioned that obesity is not the only risk factor. For some people, it's a matter of the structure of their airway or their jaw. So some people, there's these kind of custom-made dental appliances are actually a good candidate, a good option for them. So that's one option. Sometimes some people's sleep apnea is very specific to body position. So apnea tends to be worst when people sleep on their back. And so for some people, They can get these wedge-shaped pillows to keep them on their side
Okay.
at night. We call that positional sleep apnea, and that may be all that they need. And then the latest addition is a device called Inspire, which a lot of
I've
people might
heard
have
of
seen.
this.
They've had very aggressive marketing, so people might have even seen
Yes.
their commercials, which are very amusing, which is actually sort of like a pacemaker. It's an implanted device that in your sleep stimulates the base of the tongue, that tissue in the back of the airway, to keep it from relaxing so much in sleep. And so there's a, and I should say there's a few pharmaceutical companies that actually have medication treatments in development right now. So we're probably less than 5 years away from having those as an option as well.
Oh, well.
So yet another role, I think, for behavioral health providers is, again, in the scope of instilling hope, helping patients to consider, okay, well, maybe if one treatment didn't work for them or it's just not agreeable for them, there are other options to look into. Don't give up. And give
Yeah.
up on treatment. Be willing to try a few things to see what works best for you.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. Which perhaps sleep medicine physicians, as you're saying with backlog, don't always have time to be
Yes.
having that discussion in the same way that we might.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'll just add to that most sleep centers do not have a behavioral health person on staff. And so
Right.
if you're looking for referrals, and you're interested in sleep, contact your local sleep provider
Yeah.
because you will be their best friend. I mean, they are desperate. So many centers are desperate to have someone to send these folks to.
Yeah.
Corinne's writing this down.
I already knew that. Thank you
Okay.
very
Of
much.
course. Of course
Yeah.
you did.
Well, Kevin, have you learned anything from this discussion
Yes,
so far?
tons. Yes. Very personally applicable, I'll say.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I have certainly learned a lot. I want to make sure our listeners walk away with some actionable intel as well. But before we get to that, we want to ask you, Phil, the question that we've been asking all of our guests this season.
And you're the last one getting this question.
That's right. So it
Oh,
better be good.
I feel
It
special. Yeah.
better
No
be a
pressure.
good answer. We have been asking all of our guests, who's got your six? Because we're in season six. So who's got your six? And you have a background in working with military personnel, so you know what that means. You know that means who has your back, who's looking out for you. And so as you're doing this work and all of the different types of work that you do, Phil, which is expansive, when things get tough, either personally or professionally, who's got your six?
I guess fortunately, I have a few in my corner, but one that comes to mind is actually a colleague here in my Department of Psychiatry who happens to be a psychiatrist. And so we also sleep researcher and sleep clinician, so we can kind of support each other clinically, and we actually collaborate in terms of our research. But even just navigating, our department and our institution, someone who I kind of really rely on for that kind of that understanding of how our department and institution works.
Nice. Nice.
Love that. It's always good to have a buddy at work. Like,
I wish I had one of those. I don't have any of
yeah.
those. I don't have
I've got
anybody
a
at work.
lot, but we'll work with you, Corinne.
That is the message that we try, one of the many messages that we try to get across to our listeners, that none of us is doing this work alone, and we need to have good supports in place to help us, whether it's with the logistical institutional stuff or the patient care or the research funds or the personal ups and downs as well. So that was a decent answer, I think, to wrap up our season with
Well,
that
I'll
question.
accept decent.
I
I know you have high standards, Corinne, so.
do.
It's true. She does. She does. Well, and it certainly have met those high standards today. I've loved this episode. I've loved talking to you, Phil. This is the first time we've actually talked to one another,
Yeah.
but we've been kind of passing, I don't know, having what, two ships passing in the night kind of thing for
Exactly.
years, apparently.
Two dogs passing out car windows on the road in the
Right.
past.
That feeling with the air pressure and anyway. But so as we're kind of wrapping up too, the other thing we always ask all of our guests is just, as we're thinking about all the stuff we've talked about and, the role of behavioral health providers in sleep apnea treatment and assessment and such, what are a couple of things that folks can take with them from this episode, like those actionable intel items that they can apply right now to improve their practice, improve their work with their clients? What would you say?
I mean, I guess a few tools that can be really useful is one is there's some really good sleep apnea screening questionnaires out there. One of the most commonly used ones is called the stop-bang questionnaire, or the short version of just the stop. So maybe having those, some of those handy. So if you're starting to, one, you can get a sense of what some of the symptoms of sleep apnea are to pay attention to, but maybe add it as something as part of your screening measures that you use kind of clinically. I'd say two, knowing who your local sleep centers are. And developing those relationships can be super helpful. And then finally, you can, with a quick internet search, find, some good protocols for either the motivational enhancement approaches or the CPAP desensitization protocols. There's several of them out there. And so kind of having those handy to use when you've got the person who says, yeah, I know I have sleep apnea, I know I have CPAP, but I just don't want to.
Yeah, those are pretty practical and I think easy to implement tools that our listeners can take away from this. We certainly have the stop bang available already on our website, but we'll link it again in the
Great.
notes just to make it even easier for folks to find.
Yeah.
And we'll plug the rest of those resources into our notes as well. I hope this has motivated some providers, some listeners here to think about how they can help with this process. I know when I'm teaching CBTI or some of the other sleep disorder classes that we have, I'm always driving home the point that if somebody has obstructive sleep apnea or screens positive, that we need to get them to sleep medicine right away. We need to get them assessed because it is a dangerous condition. Now, I'm really glad to have more information to provide for the second part of that discussion, which is, but we can still help. We can still,
Yeah.
there are still things that we can do as behavioral health providers to help those patients along. So, this has been a great discussion from my perspective, plus, always fun to catch up with Phil.
Indeed.
Always. It's been fantastic. I've really appreciated the discussion and look forward to more. Like, this shouldn't be the last time we talk.
There's always more to talk about when it comes to sleep.
For sure.
I think that's Phil agreeing to come back for the future. So let's end there.
Yep.
Let's wrap it up. It's recorded. We got it. We
Perfect.
got it.
That was our goal for the ending though, all of season six, is get Phil on
Get Phil to
recording
come
as
back.
agreeing to come back. Yeah. Thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate you joining us for all six of the seasons. We will be back for season seven shortly. It'll be a couple months, but be watching for season seven. We'll come up with a new theme and a lot of additional fantastic topics and guests. But in the meantime, stay curious.
And mind your EVPs.
Thanks everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.